The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome back, everyone, from what I certainly see was a very productive and profitable networking session during lunch. We could barely get you guys back into the room here and assemble them together for our afternoon part of our program. And I'm very pleased to say that we have six powerhouse speakers for that, divided into two panels. Before I get to that, I want to cover just a couple of lingering points from this morning. Lest anyone in the audience, including our distance audience as well, not be aware, the Carter Center, which was referred to this morning, is the center named for and participated in by former Senator Jimmy Carter in Atlanta. He was a governor.
That's right.
And he was a president. He wasn't in the Senate. Nor did he engage in...
He was a state senator, though, before he ran for governor.
But he did not engage in anything that our current senators have engaged in, such as Senator Ensign, or I won't go down the line. Okay. That part might be edited out. The Carter Center has what's called the Carter Center Access to Information Project. That's headed by Laura Newman, who spoke at the CGS program last year. I think we'd have been here today, but for the fact that it's Yom Kippur. I just want to let you know that in the international transparency portion, if 12 pages constitute a portion of the CGS website, which is part of the handouts we have here, near the very end, literally the penultimate entry there, before we get to related adjudicative decisions, we do have a new section devoted to the Carter Center and its Access to Information Project. And in fact, as additional handouts, we also have two pamphlets that the Carter Center was kind enough to send up to us, FedEx, just this past week. One is dated February 29, 2008, and it's the result of a conference that was held there on international transparency, much akin to how I asked Commissioner Flitlet this morning whether there will be a proclamation coming from the 6th ICIC. This conference ended with something called the Atlanta Declaration and Plan of Action for the Advancement of the Right of Access to Information. And that is available to you, as is one that emanated from a follow-up conference that was held more recently in Lima, Peru, on the 28th, 29th, and 30th of this year. And I know some of the people in the audience participated in that. And that resulted in this document called America's Regional Findings and Plan of Action for the Advancement of the Right of Access to Information. This was focused upon the Americas part of the world, which is a major focus area of the Carter Center. So I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of that, because that's a big part of international transparency, and I would dare say we might well anticipate Laura Newman coming up from Atlanta, as she has done once before, to participate in CGS's fourth annual International Right to Know program that is indeed scheduled for September 28th, 2010. And I'm informed reliably that that's not Yom Kippur, it's not Rosh Hashanah, it might be Arbor Day, but we should be okay in that respect. Two other things quickly. Because of the nature of our technical or technological connection on the audio link with Oslo this morning, I did not have the opportunity to mention that we have bios on all of our speakers, including on Commissioners Liflett and Dunning, from whom you've heard. And I'll just mention very briefly about Commissioner Arne Liflett. He is now the longest serving information commissioner of any of the current commissioners worldwide, as near as we can tell. In other words, if there's one who has been serving longer and continuously, we don't know who that might be. And with respect to Kevin Dunyon, Commissioner Dunyon from Scotland, you might be interested to know that among the many honors in his long bio, the fact that he did serve as the chairman of the Friends of the Earth International, a major international organization for which he was awarded an OBE, Order of the British Empire, at the beginning of, I guess it was 9 years ago in 2000. So again, these were very esteemed gentlemen who we were able to have with us today. No less or no more so than the esteemed group that we have here to talk about transparency worldwide, because we each year take this opportunity to reflect on the sins of the past. No, that's young before. We take this opportunity to survey what's been happening worldwide in transparency, and Lord knows there have been a lot happening faster and faster as years have gone by. And to do that, we have someone who I think can fairly be described as the premier expert on transparency in China in the United States. She's an academic, as Professor Roberts is. Jamie Horsley works as the Deputy Director of the China Law Center at the Yale Law School and has been almost as prolific as Professor Roberts in her writing and research and studying in this area. And if you call New Haven and Jamie's not there, the odds are pretty darn good it's because she's in China. Would that be fair to say? Toby McIntosh is someone who has been a journalist by trade, an executive now with the Bureau of National Affairs, and he has played an increasingly significant role in international transparency, writing in connection with freedomofinformation.org, and also focusing most particularly on something that you heard about, barely referenced this morning, and that is international bodies that are involved in financial regulation. And Lord knows in the last year, that has become a matter of increasing significance. It's not just within the United States that we focus on the economy and recovery and stimulus and all those things, but it's also something quite significant overseas as well. So we're very pleased to be able to have Toby McIntosh here to talk a little bit about that amongst his experiences. Last but not least, and to my far left, at least geographically, if not also ideologically, is Tom Blanton, who just about all of you I know, I imagine, and probably just about everyone in our distance audience knows, has been the director of the National Security Archive, which I think can be characterized as the premier or principal NGO or civil society organization in the transparency realm. Tom, you're not disagreeing with that, are you? Hell no.
I'm just blushing.
You're just blushing. For many, many years, they have won a Pope Award, an Emmy Award. They have been highly acclaimed for the work that they've done. You really want a Pope Award? I was making that one up.
Yeah,
is it true? Why do you know? Every now and again, it'll be true. And they have made more FOIA requests. If you count the 2,000 that Scott Armstrong tried to pass over to them when he founded that organization 20 years ago, probably made almost as many FOIA requests to U.S. government agencies as Alastair has made to the Ministry of Defense in the U.K., as you heard this morning. And Tom's organization has been very actively involved in matters of international transparency with respect to freedomofinformation.org, with respect to Mexico, a very close working relationship with people who are very actively involved in further developing and implementing the relatively recent Freedom of Information Act of Mexico. And Tom is someone who really keeps track with his trusty sidekick, Kristen Adair, who's in the audience, of what's going on lately. So I don't think we could have a better panel to start us off this afternoon by looking at transparency worldwide, what's been happening in the last year or so. And please help me in welcoming these nice folks. I believe Toby is starting first. No.
I was.
I'm sorry.
From the particular to the more general.
My mistake, of course. It's Jamie who's starting first. And Tom will be the anchor position on the very far left. Yes.
First in war, first in peace, first in
the heart. First in the heart. Hi, everyone. It's great to be here today. Thank you, Dan, for inviting me. I think the reason we decided to go first is I'm going to focus mostly on what's going on in China, with just a couple words about some of the other Asian countries, and then we get more general and large from that point on. As Dan said, I've been working in China for a number of years now, and ever since I joined the China Law Center, which is like an NGO within the Yale Law School, in 2002. I've been a lawyer before and other things, but spoke Chinese already and had lived in China a couple times. And one of the very first projects I started working on after joining the China Law Center was working with the government of Shanghai, which in China is sort of like Washington, D.C. There are four very large cities that have the status of a state or province in China with legislative powers of their own, too. And what had happened at that point, by the time we started working with them, is that the city of Guangzhou, known as Canton, which is very close to Hong Kong, had been the very first place in China to adopt freedom of information, or what they call open government information statute, which was only applied within Guangzhou City. But it was quite amazing to come out of a country with a long tradition of secrecy, which was still, a communist country, that suddenly they have this local measure saying that government has the obligation to disclose a wide range of information. And for the first time in Chinese history, 5,000 years of it, Chinese people have a right to request information from the government. So Guangzhou had put this thing out there, and Shanghai wanted to do it better. They wanted one too. They're an international city. They want to, the international financial center. They want to attract investment. They want to be at the forefront of things in China. And they are often taxed by the central government to try out things. So they will come out with local regulations on a whole variety of things to be one of the first in China, like a pioneer that others can then study. So they came to the China Law Center and said, can you work with us? And at that point, it was sort of like blind leading the blind. I had never really studied FOIA. I didn't know that much about it. And I brought her here. Unfortunately, we had access to a lot of good folks here in this room, and Tom Sussman, who's not, but all kinds of people who helped us start working with the Chinese. And Shanghai then came out with a very good provision that also looked more at the implementation phase, as Laura Newman and her colleague recommend in their article. As you're drafting the law, you should be trying to think about how is this thing going to be implemented, and what can we put in the law to try and help ensure that it will be carried out. And so Shanghai adopted the idea of an annual report, which at least forced officials to start keeping track of statistics. And in fact, they required that the annual report not only do statistics, but talk about what are their major problems and what are their plans for improving the system in the following year. And also had a requirement that every government agency had to establish an office and let the public know how to contact it to get information. They had to come out with an information catalog, the list of information that the agency holds. They had to prepare an information guide so citizens would know where to go and how to access it, and then the annual reports. And they also included, clearly, remedies. Guangzhou had not specified that in addition to traditional rights to complain to the government or to go through with an administrative appeal internally, that specifically people should have a right to go to court and sue. Now, Shanghai passed this regulation, and it really created quite a stir. The mayor was heavily behind it, a lot of publicity, a lot of effort went into. They had almost a year to prepare for it to go into effect, trained a lot of officials. They picked out 15 agencies that they thought were most closely related to the people, like Social Security, the Real Estate Bureau, et cetera, and worked with them to get their guides and everything in place right away. And the provision went into effect, and almost immediately someone took them to court. And she was requesting land records. And we can talk a little bit more about the significance of this, because she wanted to trace back property that had been confiscated during the Cultural Revolution. So it was a very sensitive issue. So anyway, let's move from Lucknow to Shanghai. So everybody starts trooping down to Shanghai to see how they're doing it. And within a couple of years, you had over 30 provinces and major municipalities in China that now had information disclosure provisions in place. And a lot of the central ministries had started doing it as well. And all this time at the center, they've been working on their first estate commissioned scholars to do some research and provide a scholar's draft of what an information disclosure law might look at. And then it was going through a lot of review and revision, et cetera. And you may recall in 2003 that a big incident was SARS. And there was a lot of criticism of the Chinese government not disclosing information in a timely or comprehensive way.
It was kind of like our Watergate as a stimulation to openness in government, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, but it took another 4 years. But it kind of made the government open their eyes, because SARS was not only a domestic Chinese problem, but it was international. And so they really felt it was important now to do a better job of information disclosure. And ironically, SARS outbreak was in Guangdong Province, where Guangzhou is, no one ever thought to use the Open Government Information Regulation to request information from the government, even though there's a lot of pressure to try and get information out in the early days because the rumors were flying hot and heavy. But it did get the attention of the central government, and they started talking about the need for full disclosure and that kind of thing. And I think it did sort of make it more urgent, but it still took a while. They sent someone from the center, from the state council to Yale in 2006, and several people helped look, and they were sharing drafts at that time of what they were looking at, and we were working on it. But then it sort of disappeared into the state council, and nobody saw anything, and they did not make a draft of this regulation public for comment, even though a lot of people had been suggesting that this might be appropriate. And then in early 2007, the state council announced that it had adopted open government information regulations, a nationwide regulation, in principle. But they had to work out some details. So again, we still don't know what the draft says at that point, and it didn't actually get published until April of 2007, to great excitement. So it's been in effect now for a little bit over a year, and so I want to focus more on what's happening than maybe on the technicalities of it. I did write an article for TOMS, the publication freedominfo.org, about the regulation when it first came out, and just briefly, what they did is pretty much adopt the Shanghai institutional structures, which is great, which requires that within China, which is a unitary government, the regulation applies not only to the central government, but to all levels of government, province, county, and large municipality, all the way down to the township, that now suddenly every single government and all the government agencies within it have an obligation to disclose seemingly a wide range of information. And they have to do the annual reports and the information guides and all the other things that we talked about in Shanghai. So they had about a year to prepare for this. And did a lot of trainings and outreach and publicity, et cetera. But the main problem is on the actual content of the disclosure obligation. And on that side, the regulation as it came out was very weak and very disappointing. You know, some of the local regulations that gone into effect even talked about the right to know. They had very strong language. A couple of them even established clearly that disclosure is the rule, non-disclosure is the exception. This was a phrase, by the way, that was taken up by very high-level Chinese leaders of both the Communist Party and of the government side, but it wasn't included in the law. And in fact, the disclosure mandate was pretty weak and very cautious. And so, for example, as a general principle, you cannot disclose information that will affect state security, public security, economic security, or social stability. They're called the three securities and the one stability. So. And in the penalties provision, officials who disclose what should not be disclosed are penalized. So everything was very cautionary in the content of what could be disclosed. On the other hand, the good part is that China really puts a lot of emphasis on the affirmative disclosure or automatic disclosure, whatever function of government. In fact, their assumption is that all information that the public needs to know is going to be disclosed by the government. But they do give lists, and they go, the central government, certain kinds of information should definitely be disclosed. You know, at each level of government, what are the kinds of information that would be particularly of interest? And it includes a very good basic list, including budget and expense information of governments, information about like food safety and natural disaster information, information about land takings and urban redevelopment issues, which have been very hot in China, everything. So this looks pretty good in terms of what their list of affirmative disclosure obligation is. Very weak on the request function. And again, I think what happens is it went all the way to the State Council, folks who didn't really know how these laws work. And their assumption is that because our law says they have to disclose all this information, they will. And so therefore, the only reason people might need to file a request is because they wanted some information relating to themselves that other people probably aren't interested in. And so they have phrased the request function very narrowly, that you can request information that relates to your own, called production or livelihood, you know, your own situation, your research, or your science and technology related affairs. And then they do have a et cetera in there too. But you know, the focus is you've got to show a need for the information is basically what they're doing. So it undermines the ability of people to use this statute to get interest, your public interest type information. But it did have that et cetera in there. So, you know, we were hoping things might be interpreted a little more broadly during the implementation phase. So what happened? They had this year to prepare, but even as we approached the date when it was going to go into effect, which was May 1st, 2008, people knew. A lot of governments just really were not prepared. They still didn't quite understand what they were supposed to do.
Was that right before the Olympics, coincidentally?
It was the same year, but I don't think it had that much to do with it. Although it might have. You know, you never know. Maybe they knew the Olympics was coming and they wanted to get into effect beforehand.
Just speculating. I don't know.
Yeah. Hard to know. But anyway, so
how did this affect the existing stronger, better major province, Shanghai, et cetera?
Yeah, I'll talk about that in a minute. Okay. Yes,
that's
yes.
A good question.
It's a very big question. So they knew as they approached the state that a lot of the government agencies really weren't prepared. You know, it was all the way down. And again, this will sound familiar. These people were not given additional personnel resources. They weren't given extra budget. You know, really, they had to just add it on to their other jobs that were going on in most places. There are some wealthier places like Shanghai that, you know, had the money to put in special facilities, et cetera. But so government was in a bit of a chaos as this date approached. On the civil society side, there had been quite a bit of publicity about this going into effect. And on the date that it took effect, there was a lot of media coverage. Now, May 1st was a holiday. It's International Labor Day. But on the first business day after that national statute went into effect, boom, requests filed, lawsuits brought within 3 days. And they weren't professors or lawyers. These were a group of retirees in Hunan province that were very upset because 5 years ago, their public water supply company had been privatized. And in the course of which some people lined their pockets and a lot of workers got let off. And at first they didn't get the benefits they were supposed to get. And they've been fighting for information because they knew the government, based on complaints, had done an investigative report and they wanted a copy of that report because they wanted things fixed. In the course of complaining, they eventually got their benefits back, but they still wanted this report to be disclosed. In the first 7 days, there were wide media reports of at least 7 cases, so they call it the 7 cases in 7 days phenomena. And again, a wide variety of people. There was a group of law professors in Peking that immediately filed a request for information about the expressway that leads to the airport in Beijing. Originally, that was built on sort of a build, operate, transfer thing, and they said as soon as they paid off the cost of that, no more tolls. Well, here it is, 30 years later, and they're still collecting tolls. Meanwhile, the expressway has been privatized with a lot of government backing, and so all those tolls are going to a private company. Now, I must say, this is another good aspect of the Chinese law. They did include provisions in there that will cover companies and institutions that are carrying out government services. So they have anticipated this sort of private contractor phenomena. However, they said that the state council will issue implementing regulations to say how you deal with that. And so what happened, these Peking law professors, is they were given information that the government had up to the point it was privatized, but they said, but you have to go talk to the company about the rest of it. And what happened then is we were approaching the Olympics, and so they were asked, please, just cool it for a while, let's get through the Olympics, and then you can pursue your request further.
That's called here in this country the Peking duck. Not over there, I doubt it's called that over there.
But anyway, we had a variety of different lawsuits and things being brought by different kinds of people. Farmers, a guy who wanted information about motorcycle stuff, whatever, and the press was covering it very actively in the first days. Now in China, the courts are weak and traditionally have not been transparent. They don't have a tradition of publishing court records. So one thing that happens is you get these cases reported as they break out, but then you often don't know whatever happened to them because it's not a follow-up and whatever. Another interesting phenomenon is I have yet to read a case brought by a journalist themselves. So they're very good at encouraging others to do it and walking with them down to the OGI office to follow what happens, but journalists themselves are not yet using the law. In fact, there was even a question when it came out whether they were allowed to use it under the law. So I think that's been clarified that, in fact, they are. So anyway, I think we had some good experience going forward, and a lot of academics began to get interested in the phenomenon now that there was a regulation actually in place. And so a lot of them got involved with government in trying to do trainings. A couple of them have founded sort of centers, academic centers, that would look at these issues and work more with civil society groups. So a word about civil society in China is, as a lot of you probably know, it's fairly weak. The government, communist government, has not been very enthusiastic about allowing the unbridled development of civil society. They have come to recognize over the years the benefits and the help that civil society organizations can provide. So in China, as in around the world, one of the areas you first see the emergence of real domestic NGOs is the environmental area. And while at first they were a little askance, and a lot of these groups had to get international funding in order to survive, they found they were very useful in helping spread the word about the laws, helping ensure enforcement, you know, by the public of the laws. Of course, what they don't like is when they then start advocating or taking the government to court. That's a little different, but they did see the benefits. And then after such things as SARS, they were very impressed about the role of civil society in Hong Kong in helping deal with the SARS outbreak there. And then more recently, we had the Sichuan earthquake, you know, just before the Olympics. And again, this amazing outpouring of charitable, not only giving, but people rushing there to try and help and forming NGOs and that kind of thing. So, and China's working on a charity law, and they're working to try and revise their rules. But they're still basically, you know, unsure about the role of civil society. I think that things like this OGI regulation and a complementary development of channels for public participation in policy making and legislation are actually going to stimulate the development of civil society. Because that's another thing that the government sees, is that civil society can be very helpful in reflecting the desires or the understanding of the public to them. So I think, you know, civil society, Chinese style, seems to be a lot of these environmental NGOs and a few sort of that focus on children and other disadvantaged groups. These are encouraged by the government. And then another aspect are these centers that are being founded by academics, because they have special standing in China, and they can do some legal aid centers, but they can also do research and work with civil society themselves. So, for example, I mean, some of them are very exciting. A professor in Shanghai has done, after the first year, an evaluation of transparency, budget transparency in 31 provinces. So he's focusing on budget and government expenses, and was able to get information out of a lot of the governments. Not all of them. Some will come out and say budget information is a state secret. But, you know, he's able to get enough, and he put together an index and he published it. And it got the attention of governments, and it makes the governments feel competitive, because the government, you know, they say he's doing good, but they're not, they want to know why. And what do they have to do in order to get a good score? Another center at Peking University is organized what they call the OGI, Open Government Information, OGI Watch Alliance. At the first year of implementation of this regulation, actually it was really closer to, I guess, 8 months from May 1st, 2008 to the end of the year, 2008. Remember, everybody had to do their annual reports, which were due by March 31st. So they did an evaluation of the first year's government performance. A lot of it was based on who got an annual report out, and was it on time, and what was in it, what did it show, you know, with some information from the newspapers and other things too. So it was very unscientific. And everybody was very upset because less than half of the governments passed. They got a score that was deemed not passing. But what the guy who did it was thrilled about was that they paid attention to it. And the same thing, they were calling up saying, why didn't I get a better score? What do I have to do to be better? What are your indicators? And so in fact, going forward, they're going to try and develop a methodology and be more systematic and develop teams in different areas of academics and their students who can help them do this. They want to do quarterly OGI watch reports and then annual reports that sort of sum it all up. So I think this is civil society, right? I mean, it's very, very exciting to see this kind of thing develop. Now, individual lawyers are also using the law and bringing some lawsuits, and some of them are very interested. Some of you may have heard about the case where in China has a stimulus plan, just like the U.S. does, and very little information was made available about the stimulus plan. So
Was it here or in China? Or both.
I said this sounds very familiar.
Both.
So, yeah,
yes.
Both. So the Shanghai lawyer brought a lawsuit against, well, first of all, I filed a request with the Chinese Ministry of Finance and a very powerful commission called the National Reform and Development Commission. which also works on budget and finance type stuff, and asked for information about this. And the first response was that we can't give you information about either the national budget or the stimulus plan until it's been approved by the National People's Congress, which meets in March. So we went back and said, look, citizens ought to have a right to see the draft budget and the draft stimulus plan, actually, before they're actually implemented, so that we can have some input before you make your decision. But they still deny it. And some places, I'm going to say, are beginning to do this. They're beginning to get into more participatory budgeting, but it's a very, very early days. But what happened then is after the NPC, National People's Congress, did approve the budget, they published more information than ever published before. And they did it in a way, pie charts and all kinds of things, where the response, it wasn't still detailed enough, but it was quite astounding. They'd never seen anything like this before. Now, on the stimulus plan, they still haven't gotten much information, particularly about how it's actually being implemented, but they're still working on it. And this lawyer, so he got part of it, which was great, but not enough. He sued. And it went through both levels, and the final one was the Beijing High Court, and they just simply said, we don't have jurisdiction over this case. Now, that leads to, I guess I should wrap up, too. The last thing is the courts, because the courts are very weak. They're considered part of the government, actually, in China, even though they're not subject to OGI. And because of the way Chinese law is written, you do have the right to sue the government, but only if it affects your personal interests or your economic interests. And so is right to information a personal interest or an economic interest, and how do you prove it? So almost every court has either refused to accept lawsuits brought at all, or has said, we have no jurisdiction, or your request is not, you know, we can't, it's not handled under our administrative litigation law, you know, and sent it back. But actually, a few courts have taken these cases and have ordered governments, you know, to respond to requests where they haven't responded. In one case, they even ordered costs, which, you know, you never hear about in China. They made the government pay the lawyer's costs for the plaintiff because, you know, they should have responded to the request. And another case, the one that really got me the most, was these retired workers in Hangzhou, again, worried about benefits and stuff. They wanted copies of the government meetings, of minutes of a meeting where they had decided about what was going to happen in this reorganization of the entity. And they took it to court, and the court agreed and ordered the government to release those meeting minutes to the workers who were sitting in court. And on hearing the result, they burst into tears. They had never dreamt, you know, the power of this thing. So while most of the evaluation of what's happened in the first year is very critical, you know, most of these cases are being turned back, a lot of information is being given, the government's not working. I mean, this is the first year, and this is a country that is still one-party rule. This country has not gone through the democratic transition yet. China considers itself a socialist democracy, but it's not a democracy like we know it. They're dealing with a situation where it's not a new government, so you can open up the files, it's the same government. And the really, one of the really intriguing things about this is why are they doing it, and where is this going? Because I'm one of those who thinks potentially this had to have very, very powerful ripple effects, and I think we've already seen it. The party is now talking about open party affairs. The courts are now working. This is a big plan this year, is judicial transparency. They're starting to publish decisions online. They're starting to publish enforcement information online. You know, never, even though they're not covered by the OGI regs, National People's Congress is getting more transparent. So anyway, I'm very encouraged by what's happening, even though there are many challenges ahead and there's still a lot of problems with the law. But, you know, when you look at these pockets of things and you work with these reformers who are doing these amazing things, you have to feel more optimistic. Oh, I was just going to say, Vietnam is working on a law, and they've been looking at the Chinese experiment, as you might imagine, you know, being communist. But interestingly, some elements in Vietnam have concluded that they don't want to follow the China, or look at China closely, because it was a top-down effort. They are interested more like South Korea, or maybe India, because there was more civil society input to it. And the other big thing, which Dan knows now, is that Taiwan also has an access to information statute for a while. There hasn't been a lot of information put out there, but you have quite a number of the Asian countries now that do have freedom of information, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, which is a region, and others, Philippines doesn't really, but they're very open society and other things as well. So the whole Asia region, Indonesia is now thinking about it, Thailand, maybe Hong has some good examples from Thailand, has one as well. And so a lot of action out in the Asian region as well, which is fascinating stuff.
Jenny, that is a stunning, stunning description, and you have to sort of take a step back every now and again and catch your breath and say, this is China we're talking about, right? And just remember, wow, what does that mean in and of itself? I thought for a moment there that you were about to tell me about a similar thing going on in North Korea. That's how it sounded you were heading at one point.
Maybe, but so they haven't let us know about it.
By the 4th or the 5th annual International Right to Know Day, perhaps Professor Horsley will come back and tell us about North Korea, because I got to tell you, as implausible or laughable as that may sound to you folks today, it wasn't that long ago, was it, that China would have done equally so. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Okay, let me turn up next to Toby McIntosh. To pick up a little bit on what you were talking about with respect to stimulus or economic budget, economic meltdown transparency, call it what you will. Because that's a big factor, or rather I should say, international organizations that are financial in nature, like the World Bank, for example, are becoming a bigger and bigger part of the overall international transparency landscape, so to speak.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on. And I continue in the optimistic vein, I think, which you've established here. I work primarily around international financial institutions, which we call IFIs. So that's my acronym du jour. And I'm going to deliver some provisionally good news as well, I hope. I also work with a group called the Global Transparency Initiative. And I just want to tell you a little bit about that, because we've been, I think, fairly influential in trying to influence what's happened at the IFIs. We were a group that was formed in 2003 as a combination of development groups and FOIA experts, including Tom. And the idea was to blend the strong interest by development groups in figuring out what's going on in these big agencies, which include the World Bank, the IMF, the Asian Development Bank, the Small African Development Bank, the American Development Bank, and the Asian Development Bank, primarily. So we wrote a charter with 9 principles, which none of which would be particularly unusual to you, but to the banks it was kind of a shock, I think. We built around the idea that transparency is a human right. We talk about things like having a presumption of disclosure and narrow and clear exemptions. This was rather unusual. 2 organizations which basically had built their policies, and their disclosure policies only go back a little more than a decade, but their policies were largely built on what they call positive or negative lists about what would and wouldn't be disclosed. And your chances of actually asking for something that wasn't on the positive list and receiving it were pretty slim. So our engagement with the IFIs also covers a number of things which aren't strictly speaking FOIA matters. We talk a lot about disclosure of materials in advance of decision making, more of the Administrative Procedure Act kinds of things. We talk about whistleblower protection and good dissemination practices, and also translation, which is, as you can imagine, also fairly important issue for the IFIs, or for us at the IFIs. So the GTI has been fairly active. We send delegations there. We write reports. We send them information. We've just finished a model policy for the World Bank, which for the first time takes our principles and tries to and tacks on all the detail that we think ought to be in a model policy. The World Bank, as a matter of fact, is reviewing its disclosure policy right now, and we're in the middle of that effort. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Overall, progress has been incredibly incremental, I'd have to say, but we're really on a good glide path, I think. These windows of opportunities to influence the IFIs only occur every 2 or 3 years. They set up a policy of having reviews of their disclosures. Disclosure policies, and we jump in when we can to take advantage of it. And then pretty much the issue sort of hibernates. In January, the World Bank, because of some of the scandals around contracting, said they would disclose information about banks or about banks and corporations with whom they weren't going to do business anymore. That was a little one of those little breakthroughs we have occasionally. But obviously, disclosure is a huge issue. It involves millions of dollars and affects the lives of lots of people in countries where people who participate who are most affected probably have the least power. And transparency problems continue to exist. We just analyzed a report that the inspection panel at the bank did recently, and by looking at the numbers a little more closely, it turned out that there were transparency problems alleged in 42% of their 52 cases that were brought in the last 5 years. So it comes up a lot as an issue for affected people in dealing with the bank. We had a case just recently involving an NGO just brought a complaint against the bank because they want the translation in Arabic of documents which the Yemen government deals with, and between the bank and the government, and they refused to translate them into Arabic, so we're appealing that to the bank. Those are some of the kinds of things that we throw the real world kinds of items that come up for us. There's a lot of entrenched pressures within the bank and from the governments to oppose more disclosure, but we're finding that their need for greater legitimacy and a growing understanding that the procedural openness makes for better outcomes is seriously influencing the way they're looking at that, which is good. There are not too many statistics on the numbers of requests that they get. The Asian Development Bank has some elements of the policy which are better than others. And last year they had about 1,000 requests for information, official requests for information, and they only turned down about 7%. And interestingly, as we know from other FOIA experiences, the business community is pretty interested in them. And one of the areas they turned down is requests for detailed information about bonds. I can't even understand the structure of the way they do bonds at the AEB, but the people are quite interested in it. I want to focus a little bit on the bank because what's going on there now illustrates pretty much what we're up against in most of the other institutions, and also because since it's Rights to Know Day, we should have some good news, and it's basically good news. We've been trying to get them to put some teeth behind what they've said they had for some years, which is a presumption of disclosure. They've said that in the last half dozen years, but it really hasn't been entirely true.
Isn't that something that Mr. Wolfowitz said as well during his tenure?
Yeah.
And there was some question as to whether he's merely giving lip service to that or not.
Well, that's what we've said. We've said it's pretty much lip service. But this time around, they have a draft out. They put out a draft this spring. And it actually does have a presumption with some better defined exemptions. Now, as these things go, we of course think they're too broad, and particularly they give too much, they give basically veto power to countries in some situations, and also category of commercial information is also a little too expansive for our taste. But we're still hopeful because one of the categories where it looks like we're really going to make some gains has to do with documents that are evaluative in nature, things that come out after a project or a policy has been implemented and they try to evaluate that. We have very little information, and there's lots of traffic between the countries, from the bank officials in country, that kind of thing. We've had no access to at all heretofore. So we're also likely to get some kind of a public interest override, some kind of a harm test, which we managed to get a few years ago with the Asian Development Bank, which was kind of a breakthrough. And so we're looking to get something along those lines, which gives us another opening when we eventually get into some more complicated tests. I say this all provisionally because the board is supposed to deal with this in about a month, and we're waiting. Any day now we're going to get their final draft proposal, and then we'll look at that and then continue our lobbying. But we've heard some pretty positive things about what the staff is recommending and the direction in which the board is has gone and the way they work. They've had some long discussions about this before they get to this stage, so we're fairly hopeful. We're going to get some better procedures for making requests, just some of the nuts and bolts kinds of things, which are so valuable to have spelled out clearly. We're also going to get an independent appeals panel, or a quasi-independent appeals panel, but we're still going to be happy to have any kind of appeals panel, but we're pretty positive about that. You'd think that these kinds of getting a draft of the policy would be something that would be completely normal, but that's also something we've had to fight for over the years, as they do not just the disclosure policy, but also lots of other larger policies where they have consultations, but then at the very end, before the board takes it up, they don't put out a final draft policy. They call it a draft policy, but that's kind of a misnomer because, in fact, the draft is this final staff recommendation. It embodies lots of consideration within the bank, and it's what the executive directors get only a couple of weeks before they decide what to do. So we've asked for simultaneous disclosure, project appraisal documents, which is the main staff recommendation around projects, now get disclosed after the board is acted. So what we're hoping is we get project appraisal documents and many other materials like that when they go to the board and get this simultaneous disclosure. The IMF is also thinking about a new disclosure policy, and they've told us, and we've reported, that they're definitely not going to give us a draft of their new disclosure policy before the board considers it. And they have also some of the same kinds of infirmities that we find in the World Bank, the Article 4 reports, which I occasionally read about in the paper, where they talk about the IMF evaluation of a country. Those are very important reports which talk not only about the conditions in the country, but also about what sorts of things they should take up as their formula for changing things. Those are released, but with a veto power of the country, so they can say no. Just the other day, China decided for some reason not to allow the release of its Article 4 report. So these kinds of
exchange rate policy, I'm sure.
Probably, yes. They did it before, and they released it before, but they decided for some reason not to this time. The IMF also allows for about 10% of the countries refuse to allow disclosure of their Article 4 reports. And there's also a policy of deletion, so if there's something like the exchange rate policy mentioned, they could actually go ahead and we could get that deleted too. So
partial disclosure.
Partial disclosure. And there's no administrative review or appeal mechanism for any of that. So the possibility that we're going to get these quote unquote draft documents at the World Bank, we're hoping will set a quite an important precedent for other institutions. We thought that the World Bank will be a bit of a leader on this. They've been ahead of most of the banks in the past. The Asian Development Bank arguably is better in some respects, but the World Bank looks like it could make quite a big breakthrough. One of the other things we're sort of hoping for is to get summaries of the meetings. In 2005, we got a slight change. They agreed to release minutes, and they are really small. Like a meeting could fit on a page. It's just skeletal stuff. They did this. But they also prepared these really cool summaries with no names, but a nice, somewhat diplomatically worded description of what happened. But those were into 8 to 10 pages. And we've published some of those on Freedom Info, and the world didn't come to a crashing end. But they're really quite useful. Now, we're fairly radical. We'd like to see transcripts. We'd like to see open meetings. And those kinds of things are pretty much make people shut down at the bank. But actually, we have a discussion going now about possibly having a few pilot projects around open meetings, just some sort of trial open meetings, if you will. I guess to sum up there, but at the World Bank, we're really hoping to make some big changes. And although we may not be able to get all the other banks to sign on immediately, we think it's going to have a fairly significant impact. I'd just like to mention a couple of other sort of semi-related things to conclude. we're people who have enacted a good freedom of information law, we're now increasingly interested in what kind of follow-up we can do so that the use of the IFI policies is robust, so that we can test what they don't give us and push them a little farther. The bank also seems to be thinking a little bit more in that direction. Some of their programs now are aimed at trying to increase demand for information in some of the countries in which they operate. They have a program in Cambodia. And some of you are probably familiar with their efforts to work on FOIA laws in other countries. I tried to make a call this morning about something we've been following for a little while. There's been an effort at the bank to map FOIA laws. Started in 2006, and they couldn't do it, and they started again, and now they are somewhere. I don't know. I couldn't get an answer this morning about where that stands. But in fact, they are doing some fairly active work to encourage FOIA laws in particularly Latin America, but also in work in Egypt and Mongolia, Kuwait recently. They've started a series of working papers on FOIA issues. So they are doing a little bit more to address some of the delivery issues that are probably also important for people who are following projects within country, because bank documents obviously won't really do it all. There's lots of interest in trying to increase the disclosure of payments by extractive industries within countries that are affected by bank loans. The bank could do more in that regard as well. Second, I'm also increasingly interested in some of the more informal development-related meetings that occur. We ran a story about a meeting, a multi-donor meeting in Georgia, where they prepared a large document in advance about what should be talked about and what advice they wanted to give, and that wasn't disclosed within the country at all. Later they put out sort of an abridged version, but we've stuck pretty much with the standard groups, but there are these kind of other negotiations that go on, which also are not really very well described. So there's an interesting multilateral effort to try to increase the disclosure of development aid, not only by countries and the banks, but also by the large private sector donors. And that's called the International Aid Transparency Initiative. And that's, again, a move into a somewhat uncharted area where different kinds of groups who are involved in development policy will have to decide whether they're going to disclose it, have it disclosed in format so it can be compared and put into a database that could be very useful. So anyway, that's my somewhat optimistic view of where we are with IFIs, and thanks for your attention.
So thank you, Toby. You certainly, and Professor Horsley, have covered your areas in depth, but as it happens, you've left a lot of areas of the world for Tom Blanton.
I don't know. I think China might have gotten a per capita share of this panel.
If we extrapolate from that, Tom will now spend the next 12 minutes talking about India.
That's where we would go next. No, I wanted to actually start with something that Dan said in the introduction, because to me this is the wonder and the joy of freedom of information work, because he introduced me as his far left wing, but just last week I was introduced in a former Soviet republic as a notorious right winger, Tom Blanton. Because if you're for access to information, who you're against is whoever the power was. And depending on where that power was is where you are on the spectrum. And this is the wonder of freedom of information work. And so I'm proud to be both a rightist and a leftist. And I keep remembering Bill Moyers, who says about the American Eagle, you got to have a left wing and a right wing, or else the bird goes into a death spiral. And it only has one wing, one needs to go down. So it's a great idea. But this morning I was really inspired listening to Al Roberts and his tales of the information commissioners. And it put me in mind of that great story about how they used to ration automobiles in the Soviet Union. If you were a Stakhanovite worker and totally overfilled your quota, you could go in, put in order for an automobile. Gosh knows Al Roberts has overfulfilled his quota. So I'm envisioning Al, going in to see the car lady at Gosplan, to put in his order for the car, put down his life savings in rubles, and she says to him, okay, this is great. Your Volga will come in 10 years. You know, February 21st, whatever. And Al looks her in the eye and says, will that be morning or afternoon? And the car lady says, morning or afternoon? What does it matter? It's 10 years from now. What, are you crazy? And Al says, well, like they used to say in Soviet Union, well, the plumber's coming in the afternoon. This is all drawn in the reality of our Freedom of Information Act request. But the plumber's coming in the afternoon.
That's what they said during Watergate, too.
Yeah.
The plumber's coming in the afternoon.
You got it. I just want to make 5 points about the trends in international freedom of information, because I could tell you stories from all these fabulous countries, and I've been to a lot of them. My kids would say too many of them. But I just want to try to sum up with 5 points and then end with a caveat about trends. And the first point is pretty basic, that there's still a great time out there for campaigns for new freedom of information laws. And there's a lot of stuff that's happening, and the campaigns for new laws are really useful focal points, and I'll tell a couple stories. The second point I want to make is that, taking off on our discussion this morning, there really is a new norm in the struggle for freedom of information, which is it won't work unless you do have an information commissioner or some kind of independent implementing body. And that has really become a new norm, and I'll explain why. Third, I would say that the real energy and creativity in the international freedom of information movement is not so much on the passage of new laws, but in this implementation set of issues. And you can hear it every time you go to a place like China and see the Shanghai professor doing an audit of budget transparency, or in my case, working on an audit in India, or what I just came back from last week in Tbilisi, an audit of government websites. It's fascinating, interesting focus on how do you make it work, how do you make it intersect with the real information needs of people. The fourth point I would say is the biggest opportunity for the long term, for the future, I think, is in this area of proactive disclosure, where the Chinese at least are on the right path, where the benefits, the economics, the scalability of the web means there ought to be ways to put enormous data sets out there, where the processing data that Al has to go through a request to get now should just be on the web from every one of these agencies, automatically, and we ought to be able to throw teams of grad students at it to do the research about, to disaggregate it and find those trends. But that is a tremendous opportunity, and we got a lot more to do. And the last thing I would just say, the last major point, I'll come back to each one and tell a story to illustrate, is just, I think the next big challenge is not simply to take the absence or the presence of a FOIA law, whether it's 79 jurisdictions or 90 or whatever, as our measure of what we're striving for in open government. We've got to test it in other ways, and my mentor in this is a wonderful woman from the Philippines that doesn't have a FOIA law, but used local real estate and corporate records to bring down the president of the Philippines, Sheila Coronel. And she invented a metric, a methodology for how to test whether governments are open. And I think that's going to be the next direction for what we as a large community writ large are going to have to do. So let me go back to my number one point about the campaigns for new laws and why that's still a tremendous focal point. It's an incredibly useful way to build those blocks of interests and publics and constituencies and government officials that you need as a combination to make a law work. And without a real campaign that's not just top-down, that does, without a campaign that involves media, you're not going to have media attention to the new law once it's in place. Without a campaign that connects government officials the way Maurice Frankel successfully did in Great Britain, bringing the top bureaucrats in, you're not going to have a law that can actually address the culture of secrecy inside of bureaucracies. Without a campaign that builds on civil society energy, you're not going to be able to have those advocacy groups that continue to test and push the law. So I think that piece of the puzzle continues to be essential, but the energy is shifting elsewhere. But I just, coming back from Brazil, for example, this incredible phenomena of keeping up with the Joneses, and what are my neighbors doing? In Brazil, believe it or not, the example that had the biggest impact for them wasn't what, and we had Chileans there, Mexicans there, and people were doing great implementation. But the remark that I made that had the biggest impact was, I called on this funny Brazilian notion of the BRIC, B-R-I-C. Which is the block of countries that in 2050 are going to run the world, and that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, BRIC. And pointed out that RIC each had freedom of information laws and regulations, not Brazil. Boy, the Brazilians said, wow, we're lagging. This dynamic between parts of bureaucracies, between development banks, between countries, Keeping Up with the Joneses is a core piece of tools in our toolkit, and we got to keep pushing that. The second point about the new norm of the information commissioner, the Brazilian draft law doesn't have a commissioner, doesn't have implementing authority. Basically says we're going to put it up to these different bureaucracies to run it themselves. And there are a couple of interesting officials in Brazil who've done tremendous things on budgetary transparency and the like. And yet, the consensus of the international experts was the text of your law doesn't matter as much as whether there's an independent authority with some power. In a state like New York State, where the advisory legal power of an expert like Robert Freeman carries moral weight that then has the effect of an order power, maybe you can get away with it. But in countries that are transitional countries with dysfunctional judiciaries, you really need some kind of order power. And in that discussion about the Brazilian draft, the example was cited over and over of what advocates around the world consider to be the best Freedom of Information Act text as a law in the world, as granting rights, as coverage, like it was written by a bunch of South Africans. And yet if you look at whether the South African law is working today, they would say it's not. Best law text, one of the worst implementation effectiveness. For a lot of reasons, ministries have exempted themselves, the courts haven't really reinforced, the delays are forever, and it's in effect a one-party state, except an ANC one-party state today. So you get all this dysfunctionality in place. And so examples like in Chile, where they put the Kevin Dunyan of Chile, in effect, in charge of the Information Commission, Juan Pablo Almeida, who won that great case in the Inter-American Human Rights Court, finding access to information is a human right, is now the Information Commissioner. And they are drawing on the best practices of other countries. They're setting benchmarks, involving civil society. My bet is that, you know, come April 2010, we're going to be part of a big conference in Chile that we're helping them organize. They're going to have set the new gold standard for first year of implementation, because they've gone at it in this way with really tremendous power. I would recommend to Miriam bringing up Juan Pablo to say, how did he set this up? Because he's in a very tenuous political, he's in a three-way political triangle. You only have two ways you have to worry about.
Oh, so far. She has three, actually.
Oh, three, Al.
If you really know, she has at least three.
But let me go to the point number three, which is where the energy and creativity is on testing and implementing and auditing. I was part of a international consulting group as this amazing bunch of Indian grassroots activists conducted really the first serious audit. What had happened, the government of India had hired PricewaterhouseCoopers to do an audit of how well it was working. And civil society said, boy, we know those guys. Those are the guys that privatized the water supply. Those are the guys that we've always struggled with to find out what they're doing. So we're going to run our own audit. And they raised money from, guess what, Google. They got a $250,000 grant. They hired literally hundreds of workers. That goes a long way in India. They conducted something like 17,000 interviews, 600 some odd focus groups. They did 800 test rights information requests. They picked sample states, jurisdictions. They came up with amazing numbers for the use of the law in the first 2 years, almost 2 million total requests in India. Now, on a per capita basis, that's not as good as, say, Mexico or Turkey. But if you're thinking about the change in culture and the reaching into bureaucracy, it's extraordinary. The other findings I thought were really striking, there were two that really, you know, leaped out at me. One was that, and they're going to work on this, all the requesters were boys. 85% of the urban requesters, 90% of the rural requesters were all male. Ooh, what does that tell you about what civil society needs to do, what people need to do about changing who asks and for what, right? And are you really making information flow work? That was a fascinating result. And the final one that I thought was phenomenal was that the main impact of the Rights Information Act was not in the flow of information out of the government, but that in effect it had become an ombuds complaint line. That if you couldn't get your ration card and you filed an RTI request for the file behind your not getting your ration card, you got your ration card within days. If you had a problem getting into a food subsidy program because the office was only open on Fridays and you filed an RTI request about why is it only open on Friday, all of a sudden it opened every day of the week. The water wasn't flowing in your neighborhood, you filed an RTI for that, and all of a sudden the water started flowing. And so the answer to the request to avoid having to go back to the file and produce something, they fixed the problem. This is great, a signaling mechanism for effective government. This is an amazing outcome they found in the Indian case. There are many, many other examples like that, and we've had them in the U.S. as well, but the point I guess I would want to move to next is one that Jamie really alluded to, and I think is beginning to happen on the issues of budget transparency. It's certainly, if you look at the President Obama's United States Senator only passed three pieces of legislation. One was with Lugar on Russian proliferation, and the other two were on putting contracts on the web. So if you can imagine really populating those websites with serious amounts of proactive disclosure, the sky's the limit in terms of interactivity with the citizens, improving competition, eliminating the information asymmetries and the sole source contracts. Translate that around the world and the inexpensiveness of the web and what it can allow people to do. That, I think, is where the next sort of the imagination is the only limit. And we should look to some of the folks, Google and other folks who are trying, OpenCalais and other folks, trying to figure out what are the most creative ways for us to pursue this kind of open it all up and then let that horizontal distribution empower the most people that you can. And my final point just about this issue of measuring. I wrote about this years ago in 2002 in Foreign Policy, where Sheila Coronel had gone and tested all those countries of Southeast Asia and found this amazing. Singapore is the top of the heap on the Transparency International Index, which is about perceptions of corruption, openness. They're tied with the United States as the most open, transparent, no bribes for business. But when you actually go in and ask for infant mortality data and local government expenditure data or the salaries of officials or all that, Singapore's score was tied with Cambodia at under 50%. So I put a title on that, Open for Business, but Sheila's fundamental insight is that the real test of open government is not whether there's a law or not, not whether there's a right that's recognized in a text like South African law. It's can you get the information that makes a difference in your life? So we as a community have to figure out ways to test that, ways to frame that, ways to compare countries and take advantage of this keeping up with the Jones dynamic, which I think drives bureaucracies, drives countries, drives all of us. And let me just, I've listed all five of these as major trends, and so I'll end this with a little caveat. A labor statistician friend of mine has cautioned me about trends. She says that the fastest growing single job category in the United States since 1980, measured in terms of numbers and percentage growth on an annual basis, is the job of Elvis imitator. And that actually in 1999 there were about 8,000 Elvis imitators working full time. Earlier this year they tried to capture how many there were, and they're up to about 49,000. And so if this trend continues, when we resume in a couple of years at this gathering, one out of three of you will be an Elvis imitator.
Sure, tell my
so little caveat about trends. But we're at 3 o'clock, and I really appreciate your time.
Before we get up to our hips, Elvis impersonators, imitators.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Tom has been loving your tender for a long time.
Anyway. Yeah, it's a heartbreak hotel.
We do go on.
suspicious minds.
Actually, Tom could go on. We have time. We're going to use the time flexibility that we do have in this program because there's been such a richness of comments thus far from our panel that we want to make sure that we take full advantage of their being here as to cover any questions that you might have. I know I can think of a couple offhand, but let's see if maybe we can start with one or two from the audience. Anyone have a question? And if it's directed to Mr. Blanton, it must have to do with music at least of this century, previous one, of course. Yes, sir. You in the back row, far end there, yes. Now, yell very loud in order to make it all the way forward.
Toby, I want to, who are the important, is the United States basically the most important country in moving these financial disclosure sorts of apparatuses ahead? The reason this comes into my mind is that there's two FOIA cases against the Federal Reserve to disclose the information from the bailout, or one win, one loss. But I mean, I look at that as obviously the Federal Reserve doesn't want to disclose that information. Do the attitudes coming out of the United States really affect the international community? Is there quite a difference of opinions and where they're going?
The U.S. is very solid in that. I wouldn't describe them necessarily as a leader on it, and it depends on the institution. But the World Bank, they've been doing a pretty good job of pushing things. The nature of the organizations isn't quite, they're sort of subtle, you know. You don't kind of introduce their own version of what it should be, for example. And then, you know, we have to remember that the U.S. has got a good reputation on openness. It doesn't carry over in everything else. It's not always able to be a persuasive on it. Some of the other countries that have been pretty good include Canada's pretty good, and the Slavic nations have been pretty, or the sorry, the Scandinavian nations have been pretty good. The Indians have for some reason been terrible, and going to see the Indian ED this afternoon. I'm kind of curious to see what he's going to say. There have been some anomalies in you know, the way the Japanese are helpful, some of the other countries that you would expect are not very interested in openness are pretty obvious. Then some of Latin America's countries are good, some are bad. The Middle Eastern countries are uniformly awful about it. Even more than that, there are sort of institutional feelings about what the best way is to operate that don't necessarily correlate with a country and their background.
Other questions? I think I saw one back in the far corner over there.
Yes, this is for Tom. In the beginning, there was a big push to fight corruption with transparency. Do you still see that as a big issue continuing on today?
I'd say that's probably the number one motivation in many of these countries, particularly for the grassroots groups. And arguably, and Jamie can speak to this, I would bet it's one of the two or three biggest motivations for the Communist Party in China to actually adopt this because of the fears of even losing its own legitimacy as corruption became so endemic in China. And so a lot of advocates and reformers around the world have seized on the anti-corruption discourse as a way to move an openness agenda that actually does ultimately address power issues quite directly, ultimately, but that they present it as this is an instrumentality in order to have greater efficiency and reduce corruption. And you can see it. You go to, you know, a little village in Mexico where, you know, a local water authority had been bribed to look the other way while a poultry farmer just let their stuff wash into the river, and the village downstream finds out about it from some requests under the access law. Or, you know, in India where they finally, you know, they posted on the walls of the Panchayat meeting hall every expenditure for a local public works, for a ditch or for a road or for a sidewalk, and then they go around and they check. They've now built into the wage guarantee, the Rural Poverty Act, a process called social audit where they actually call for as part of the law on an annual basis in given regions for affected populations to gather, look at the books, look at the public works, look at who's on the rolls, and address what really corruption has been an overwhelming issue. So it's still very much part of the mix. But I would say now we're beginning to see other discourses. Al's book, Blacked Out, has some fabulous discussion of some of the ways in which corruption discourse, rights discourse, efficient government, deliberative decision-making, participatory discourses are all part of the package. It's very much there. Great question.
I think you're saying China, that's exactly right. All those discourses were mentioned by the Chinese, you know, in supporting adoption. And in fact, we were told that the final push to get the regulations in place came from the Communist Party Discipline Inspection Committee, which is their anti-corruption watchdog. And the party just had a plenum that a lot of people were disappointed in, but one of the big things coming out of it is another hot issue now, in addition to budget transparency, is disclosure of government official assets and income. And the party has adopted a policy, apparently, to try and get all that information from certain levels of officials. We haven't seen it yet, but it'll be out soon. I don't think that their plan is that be immediately made publicly available, but that is the pressure, and that's a trend too. So I think the corruption thing, the hope is they'll, you know, that will do it. On the other hand, then they don't let citizens file information requests to get it. So it's but clearly one of the motivating factors.
Toby, speaking of corruption, I know there's a lot of concern about corruption in Africa in connection with what you refer to as the extractive industries, and the World Bank has certainly played a heavy role there. Do you see that as something as being a potent force in Africa as well?
Well, if they could get it everywhere, I mean, they'd be a terrific amount of trouble getting good budgets, and the extractive industry flows often are not even part of the budget. So that's been the bank hasn't really, I don't think it's been terribly effective in getting these regimes in place to require that kind of disclosure. So that's obviously where a lot of the money is. So it would be, you know, a key point in fighting corruption. But the actual disclosure of those has been pretty lax.
So there's certainly room for improvement in that respect, in that continent. That's for sure. That would be a fair conclusion.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let me take the point of corruption to the next level, because I think analytically there are really two aspects to it. One aspect, when you have a tool of transparency to combat corruption, is to expose the corruption that has already occurred. And Lord knows in many nations there's enough, more than enough to go around, and a lot of exposure that can occur. But a more subtle, but perhaps even more powerful aspect of it is that transparency, when it combats corruption, can deter the corruption that would otherwise occur but for the transparency and but for the exposure that has now occurred in the past. And going forward, that's something that's of even far greater magnitude than the first category. Do you see signs of that taking place, where you have that more refined outcome, so to speak, of transparency and combating corruption?
I'll give you a direct quote from Henry Kissinger on exactly this point. I used it a week ago in a speech in Turkey, because he was meeting.
Tom, do you ever spend any time in the United States?
Every now and then. He's meeting with that. Time my weekdays is when I travel. I'm here on Regency Coach. So Kissinger's meeting with the Turks right after the Congress has overridden President Ford's veto on the amendments of 1974. March 75, Henry's in Ankara. And the Turks sit there and say, Mr. Secretary of State, we really need some weapons to help us beat up on those nasty Greeks and to have that problem down in Cyprus. And can you ship some weapons out of those NATO stores? And the ambassador, Willis McComber, is sitting in the room, and he says, by the way, we got the transcript of this meeting through the Freedom of Information Act.
The Turkish Freedom of Information Act?
No, the American Freedom of Information Act. Although they did 670,000 FOIA requests last year in Turkey. It's really, really remarkable. Level of uses. More than France and Germany put together. So it's pretty interesting. France and Germany are keeping them out of the European Union.
I heard the Turks are slipping behind Greece, however.
So the Turks say, give us those weapons out of NATO stores. This would be great. And the ambassador says, no, that would be illegal. And Henry Kissinger says, well, I used to say at meetings, the illegal we can do immediately. The unconstitutional takes a little longer. And the transcript says, laughter. And then his next sentence says, but after the Freedom of Information Act, I'm afraid to say things like that. And afraid to do things like that.
Did he say, Tom, this is an important distinction, as I'm sure you know. Did he merely say he was afraid to say? Or did he say he was afraid to do?
He said he was afraid to say.
Okay, so it still might be done, just not said or recorded in a record.
Yeah, we'll
sorry.
Now.
A good point, though, yes.
I want to say, I think that raises a question that we've all been addressing now, too, on how do you measure success? And how do we measure whether Freedom of Information and ATI regimes actually accomplish what we think they're going to do? I mean, how do you measure whether it has prevented corruption that never happened? I mean, how do you do it? And that's partly what... You know, we're all trying to figure that out at this stage, too. And if a country like China, where you're starting, they want to do some about how do you evaluate it? What do you test? You know, what were your goals? There are so many of them. So it's a very tough question. How can you shed light?
Yeah, that nuanced aspect of transparency combating corruption is so potent, yeah. But it really defies measurement. It's something you just have to extrapolate from and say there's a lot of value over many years going forward. And as time goes by, there'll be so much deterrence that no one will think twice about acting improperly, right? We've had that in this country on a cycle of every 35 years.
It was a question.
It was a question. I know this gentleman here in the second row.
Actually, in the part of the world to which I belong, there is a perception that most of corruption takes place in the defense sector, usually the buying arms, ammunition, and that sort of thing. Now, how much transparency has been achieved in most of the countries in this sector? I mean, if somebody wants to know that what sort of arms and ammunition at what bidding have been obtained, so what has been the level of transparency in this sector?
It's fascinating that you have that view, because Dwight Eisenhower had that view too. That's the biggest problem. Military-industrial complex. It's very different levels, and Al has written some about this. We've even seen some backsliding as, say, NATO has expanded. We know less and less about some countries' militaries. But this is a long-term problem. Think about the big scandals. I think who was the online magazine in India that actually took a hidden video camera and a briefcase into posing as arms dealers and caught the defense minister of India and the foreign minister of India, you know, taking the bribes or willing to take the bribes. Having spent the early years of the National Security Archive just trying to understand the Iran-Contra scandal and arms flows involving just 30 countries or so, it's a dark, dark world that is kept professionally dark. And then when you have the top staff person at the CIA just went to prison, 6 months ago, for steering secret contracts to friends of his for arms and services, rendered sole source, no outside bidding, and certainly no transparency, and probably would have gotten away with it except the person getting the contracts also was stupid enough to provide a member of Congress with entertainment, shall we say, that wiretaps were doing. But it's a huge amount of money. I would say the two big pots, and Toby might, one is the extractive industries, because if you just look at the raw resources in oil, the amounts of money boggle the mind. And then you look at the arms purchases, and the amounts of money are big. Not quite as big as in the oil world, but still incredibly big. Covered with the shroud, this claim of national security secrecy, which, it takes very extraordinary leaders to get out of that sort of reinforcing sense of threat where they keep the shroud over. I still remember my one favorite moment in the Cold War is when Gorbachev says to Reagan, okay, we'll allow unannounced inspections. And Reagan goes back to his staff people at Reykjavik and says, well, let's do that. And General Rowney says, are you kidding? We can't let any rusty rooskies onto our military base. Are you kidding? No way. Right?
We have time, I think, for one more question. There's a lady in the purple dress back in that corner.
It seems that a lot of the government in developing countries are spending a lot of money on e-government and are trying to do a lot of proactive disclosure using the internet. But there is still a lot of digital divide. I just came back from India, where I spent 2 years in a rural area. And very, very few people, especially women who study Tom, have access to the information, know about how to access it. And they have no clue what the internet is. So don't you think there still need to be investment in another form of disseminating the information, which is much more basic, using their own ways of getting the information, and try to influence governments to also think about the digital divide and these people, the masses, that might take years for them to have access to a computer or to the internet.
Exactly. I totally agree.
In China they're working on this too, because they still, actually now it's down to almost 50% are in the countryside. It used to be 70-30, they're gradually urbanizing it. They're working on the same thing. In fact, they've sort of leapfrogged the traditional phone lines and started using cellular technology in these rural areas. But you may know that in China, although they have a lot of internet users, it's a small percentage still, and they use things like internet cafes are very popular. But they started, at least down the county level, down most government offices, and they're trying to start populating schools with computers and stuff too. And it's a popular project for foreign companies and others who want to do corporate social responsibilities to be donating, but also helping work on infrastructure. So you're right, absolutely necessary. And the other side too is participation. How do you learn about draft policies and things going on if you don't have access to the internet? So it's a big issue, but it's one clearly the Chinese are worrying a lot. They call them the disadvantaged peoples, but a lot of it is this rural access thing.
That's an excellent point, because as we move further and further with more and more nations joining the international transparency community, which by definition means less developed nations or nations with very underdeveloped portions of them. I don't know what the Japanese, pardon, the Chinese word for Wi-Fi is, but I would dare say the whole country is not quite wired yet. There's a greater potential for people to be left behind. And it's easy to grab onto the whiz-bang technology and say, okay, we're going to use the internet because look at the power, the scalability, as Tom mentioned, to push things out. But it's very easy to leave people behind in jumping forward, as you said you did, between phones and cell phones, while you jump forward all the way to internet access only. Well, what are you skipping in the middle? Now, that's got to be a big theme, I guess, as international transparency moves forward.
There's also a thing that came up in Peru earlier this year about language. Even inside countries, the ability of peasants, normal people up in the mountains or out in the countryside, whether they speak the same language, read the same language as the official language, and how do you get to them? Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually an issue in our country. How do language minorities here get access to information?
We just have a digital, pardon me, language divide sometimes between what's called bureaucraties and ordinary speaking.
Right.
The report you're referring to, the declaration for the work, is what I referred to earlier, the meeting in Lima, Peru, with the Carter Center. And you certainly, speaking of a language disparity or a language diffusion, how many languages are there in China?
Well, there are a lot of, probably hundreds of dialects.
Dialects.
But the unifying thing in China is they all use the same written language.
Yeah.
It's quite outstanding. They may have to go like this to talk to each other to spell out the characters, but they all read the same. And that's, over history, has been a powerful unifying
force.
Yes.
Well, speaking of unifying forces, I think we've had a very forceful and unifying panel here. Please. Whether on the far left or the far right, it makes no difference.